Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, the prison population is being moved out at Stateville. The court-ordered decision followed legal fights over living conditions inside. But Stateville is also home to education programs that may not be available at some other institutions. We'll talk with those going behind bars to teach. Also, the history of asbestos and the company that manufactured products with the cancer-causing material in Bloomington. It's now part of a museum exhibit. We'll learn more. Legislation filed in the General Assembly would add more protections when you undergo a surgical procedure. We'll hear how a court decision in Missouri puts the future of abortion rights on the ballot and find out how farmers and homeowners are working to control invasive species. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, if you've ever been on the operating table, there's a good chance you've taken for granted the medical staff surrounding you were certified to do their jobs. And while that's mostly the case, there is one job specific to surgery where that may not always be true. A bill in the state legislature seeks to change that. Lindsay Jones has this report.
There's a lot of trust that goes into having surgery. Trust that the anesthesia will work. Trust that the nurses and doctors will take care of you, and of course, trust in the surgeon to get it all right. But there's another role that plays an important part in the operating room, and it's that of a surgical technologist. Here's surgical technologist Melissa Jensen.
We have to make sure that we have everything for the surgical case, so that's supplies, equipment, anything special for the surgeon's preference. And we do our surgical scrub, and we get in the OR, and we prepare everything for the surgery.
Now working in Northern Illinois, Jensen received an associate's degree from Parkland Community College in Champaign and then sat for a national exam that accredited her as a CST. And that path is generally how surgical technologists get into their profession. 60 plus credit hours of schooling, clinical work, and the national exam. But over the past few years, there's been a rise in online and on-the-job education training for future surgical technologists, and the Illinois State Assembly, the professional group that represents surgical technologists, is seeking to curb that through a bill that's pending in Springfield. Melissa Jensen is on the board of directors for that professional organization, but she says her own experiences working in hospitals have driven her to support the law that would require all surgical technologists be nationally accredited and trained before they work in an operating room with a patient. She says she worked in an operating room with someone who wasn't, and medical staff were doing an abdominoplasty or a tummy tuck.
You're literally cutting open their whole, their skin on their abdomen, and we have to lift it and undermine tissue. And it's a lot of suturing to close this procedure.
Surgical technologists not only prepare the operating room, but they also account for everything used in a surgery, from making sure everything is sterile and clean to making sure it's accounted for once the surgery is over.
The day I was doing this procedure, I had an individual that was working in the OR with me. Of course, I didn't agree with it, but, you know, I just went along with it, and it was time to count. So we do closing counts to make sure that no sponges or items get retained in a patient. And I went to go do my closing count, and I was missing a sponge.
The immediate fear was that the sponge had been left in the patient's body. Jensen says it took multiple staff members helping to search the room before the sponge was finally found in the trash.
We don't throw these sponges away until they are counted and we know we have every single sponge that we started with. If I wouldn't have found that sponge when I did, the surgeon and the first assist would have had to cut out all those sutures and lift this patient's stomach back up to make sure the sponge didn't get left under there.
Jensen says it wasn't the first time she'd seen an operating room staffed with someone who wasn't yet accredited or fully trained in surgical tech, but her hope is the proposed legislation will reduce the likelihood of this kind of thing happening. The healthcare profession, like many, is facing staff shortages, and there are no easy fixes to that problem. And in fact, the Illinois Health and Hospital Association said in a statement it considers the proposed legislation, quote, a solution to a problem that doesn't exist, end quote, and it also says it would, quote, exacerbate the healthcare worker shortage that plagues Illinois hospitals. But advocates for the bill argue it's necessary because while many hospitals might not offer on-the-job training to be a surgical tech, there are a few in the state that do. Springfield fixture Margaret Vaughn is lobbying for the surgical techs group on behalf of the bill.
There's only like about five hospitals that we know in the state that are doing the on-the-job training, and we do know one of the ones that there's really only like two or three people through the years that have gone through the program that are still there.
But she says even five hospitals across the state is too many, given the stakes.
If the patient was aware of it, they would be outraged, the public. And we tell the public about it, they're outraged. But it's kind of like a dirty little secret you can keep because the patient doesn't know any better and everyone has a mask on and, you know, they assume that they would only assume that everyone's qualified around that table.
Vaughn also added that online training coupled with on-the-job training for surgical technologists might not best prepare them for the work, and in gathering petition support for the bill, proponents heard stories of people being overwhelmed and eventually leaving the job altogether. The Illinois Health and Hospital Association noted the bill lacked any, quote, peer-reviewed evidence, end quote, to suggest that outcomes for patients would improve if the bill was passed. The legislation would not go into effect until 2026. Its authors say no one would lose their jobs if they were employed and didn't meet its standards. Instead, they would be grandfathered in, since the goal is to bolster healthcare staff going forward. Advocating for the bill on behalf of the surgical tech group, Margaret Vaughn says in her mind, the opinion of the surgeons in Illinois operating rooms is ultimately what matters, and more than 100 signed petitions supporting it.
At the end of the day, their liability is on the line. They're the ones that know the difference in the operating room, and when they're bringing the people in that were on the job trained, they're calling and complaining, how did I get this person? So I think their opinion should definitely matter.
The bill was introduced in the Illinois Senate in January. It's still waiting for a vote. I'm Lindsay Jones.
Many doctors have signed on supporting the requirement for surgical techs, but there are about 24 opponents, mostly healthcare organizations. Meanwhile, in Missouri, voters this fall will decide on a measure to enshrine abortion rights into the state constitution. That comes as the Missouri Supreme Court reversed a ruling to keep what's known as Amendment 3 off the ballot. Brian Moline and Jason Rosenbaum discuss how the court's decision could have a massive impact on abortion rights in Missouri.
The Missouri Supreme Court reversed a lower court ruling saying that the measure known as Amendment 3 couldn't be on the November 5th ballot because it didn't specify which laws would be overturned if it passed. The court also ordered Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft to certify the measure for the ballot, which the Republican statewide official did on Tuesday afternoon. It's a huge victory for abortion rights proponents who were watching this very rapid legal process closely. There were a lot of nerves over the past 72 hours or so, and now there's just a whole lot of relief.
And Jason, this took place the same day as oral arguments in the case. What were your big takeaways from what the lawyers had to say?
One of the key arguments that was brought forth by proponents of Amendment 3 is that Cole County Judge Christopher Limbaugh misinterpreted a statute that he thought requires constitutional amendments to say which laws would be repealed if it passed. The opponents of Amendment 3 argued that the statute speaks for itself and that voters should have a clear sense of what they're deciding this November. Clearly, the Supreme Court sided with the proponents of Amendment 3 in this case.
What has the reaction been among abortion rights supporters and opponents?
Well, abortion rights opponents say that they are now motivated to try to defeat Amendment 3, but they're going to have an uphill battle. Even Republicans like State Senator Jason Bean, who represents a Southeast Missouri Senate district that voted for Donald Trump by a huge margin, told the Politically Speaking podcast recently that he expects the abortion legalization measure to pass because he's heard from his own constituents that the current status quo, which bans abortion with the exception of medical emergencies, is just a bridge too far.
I hear that all over, to be honest. So, yes, I think exactly what you just said, not having some of those exceptions, I fear that's going to pass. I think it will.
And so it sounds like you think this measure has a pretty good chance for passage when voters decide on it in November.
I think so. And while I would say anything can happen between now and November, the proponents of Amendment 3 have a huge financial advantage. There's also polling from St. Louis University and YouGov showing that it has about 52% of the vote. And that's before any ad campaign has started. And Tori Schaefer, who's an attorney that helped defend Amendment 3 in court, is also confident that Missourians will find favor with her proposal.
This case was about whether the people's right to engage in direct democracy would be protected or if it was just a right in name only, vulnerable to the whims of politicians. Today, the court affirmed that the people will have the final say.
It all sets up a very high-stakes showdown on November 5th, and it could change the face of abortion rights policy in Missouri for the foreseeable future.
Jason Rosenbaum, political correspondent with St. Louis Public Radio. Jason, thanks for your time and your insight today.
Thank you.
Well, we're nearing that time of the year again with the corn harvest. Last year, people from 14 states gathered at a farm outside of Good Hope in western Illinois, and they all had something in common. They were there to compete in the National Corn Husking Contest. Rich Egger brought us that report, and today we revisit that competition.
One, two, three, go!
And with that, 21-year-old Caroline Robbins of Macon, Mississippi, started tearing corn off the stalk. She wore a special glove with a hook to remove the husk. Then she tossed the ear of corn off a backboard and into a large wagon pulled by a slow-moving tractor. Then it was on to the next corn stalk. She repeated this for 20 minutes as the clock ticked down.
15 seconds.
This was the day before the national competition. Robbins needed to complete a round to qualify for the nationals.
3, 2, 1. We're done.
Good job, Caroline.
Her work was not done when time ran out. Robbins had to shovel all that corn out of the wagon and into a large tub so it could be weighed and inspected by judges. Robbins describes herself as a competitive person who loves sports. She grew up playing softball and has also played volleyball and basketball. Those are team sports. Corn husking is an individual competition. She says she just focuses and tries to be the best she can at it.
I am competitive with myself, so I want to do better than I did the last time, and I'm a hunter too, so if I've killed something this way, I want to get the bigger one next time or kill it with a different weapon.
Robin says her arm cramped up a bit after 20 minutes of corn husking, but it was not too bad. Her advice to someone who has not done this before?
To be fast and to watch the next piece of corn as you toss the other into the wagon, and to have fun and remember your history.
Robin says her grandfather farmed in Indiana. As a child, she watched him in corn husking competitions, and her mother competed too, so it was only natural that she would give it a try. Robbins qualified for the nationals in the division for women ages 21 to 49, though she did not win that category. Other categories included girls and boys age 14 and younger, and women and men age 75 and older. Rich Egger reporting.
Controlling disruptive plants from faraway places has become a nonstop part of the job for many Midwest ranchers, park workers, and homeowners. From the podcast Up From Dust, Celia Yopis-Jepson reports on policy changes meant to help.
Each spring, workers at Shawnee Mission Park grab chainsaws and machetes, climb into off-road vehicles, and scour hundreds of acres in search of white flowers.
I'd assume about 35 years ago, someone decided that this would be a gorgeous, you know, blooming species to plant along the entry to the theater.
Matt Garrett is the natural resource manager for Johnson County Park and Recreation District. He's been fighting this fight for years. I first met up with him in 2022 while he and his crew searched for invasive Callery pear trees, aka Bradford pears. We drove past dozens of stumps, big trees that the crew had already killed, and searched for saplings, which park worker Matt Deer wounded with a machete, just enough to squirt some herbicide into them.
I'd say in a couple weeks to a month or two, that tree will eventually die.
Many non-native plants will not go rogue, but the small percentage that do make endless headaches for landowners. Callery pears don't die unless you poison them. Another massive hassle, the brush species Sericea lespidisa. Strong City rancher Daniel Mushrush said it annoys Flint Hills landowners to no end as they try to keep it out of Tallgrass Prairie.
It should be right up with heroin and cocaine.
You mean it should be banned?
Yeah, you shouldn't be able to have it. It's really a problem.
Kansas already restricts it, But he noted Missouri doesn't. Invasive plants have become widespread in every corner of Kansas, rural and urban. Fighting them takes time, money, and its own toll on the environment, like when herbicide is involved. But a number of invasive species form stands of such dense vegetation that they smother native plants, displacing livestock forage or making it harder for native wildlife to feed and to reproduce. Native plants sustain the food web, and people like Gerardo Zapata of Kansas City, Kansas, want to see more of them.
My favorite native plant for Kansas is the butterfly milkweed. We planted so many in our lots. I see tons and tons of butterflies, like, just swarming around the area.
One of my colleagues caught up with Zapata and other KCK high schoolers a few summers ago while they worked for the Green Team, part of a nonprofit called the Groundwork Northeast Revitalization Group. Public concern about the environment has fueled a growing appreciation of native plants and a frustration with the invasive ones transforming natural areas. Here's fellow Green Team member Oliver Faulkner.
I don't know, when I was a kid, I thought of honeysuckle as, like, nice. And then I found out it's killing all these other plants, and I was like, dang.
Bush honeysuckle shades out wildflowers, and it's widespread around Kansas and Missouri cities. Calorie pear now grows unchecked all over Missouri and much of Kansas. When the Kansas Department of Agriculture announced it was considering rules against the pears, hundreds of people wrote in, more than 90% in favor of the idea. Carol Baldwin testified publicly in January. She's a rangeland management specialist at Kansas State University.
If you look across the state line into Oklahoma, you can see the absolute devastating damage that these trees have done to native rangelands.
Starting in 2027, no one is allowed to bring the species to Kansas or move it within the state. In Missouri, the legislature held recent hearings on stopping the sale of several invasive plants, including calorie pears and Sericea lespidisa. That would frustrate businesses that grow and sell these products, which has fueled some opposition. The proposal includes a grace period to let the industry sell current inventory and adjust. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Celia Yopis-Jepson.
More ahead on Statewide. Stay right here. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Stateville Correctional Center is notorious for its hazardous living conditions, visible mold, unsanitary drinking water, rodent infestations, the list goes on. Civil rights lawyers argued the conditions are unlivable, and a judge agreed. He ordered the state to move prisoners out by the end of this month. They're being sent all over the state, in most cases hours away. A problem is Stateville is home to flourishing education initiatives, and there are questions if the men being moved will be able to continue. Sasha Ann Simons talked with some of those involved with providing education on the inside, including Flor Esquivel, the administrative director for the Illinois Coalition of Higher Education in Prison.
It's a critical issue that affects students. It affects not just their education, but their well-being. Mm-hmm. And so I'm here with our colleagues, too, to be able to share what are the challenges and barriers and what can we do to ensure that there's some type of holistic transfer, if possible.
Let's get into it. Alice Kim is here, too. She's the director of practice for the Center for the Study of Race, Politics, and Culture at the University of Chicago. She also facilitates a think tank at Stateville through the Prison and Neighborhood Arts Education Project. Hey, Alice.
Hi. Thanks so much for having us.
Of course. And Phyllis West is the director of the Social Justice Initiative at Governor State University. She also teaches at Stateville. Great to have you here, Phyllis.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So back to you, Flora, because I really do want you to catch us up. Tell us the plans that the Illinois Department of Corrections, or IDOC, has shared regarding Stateville's closure.
I think that's part of the issue, the transparency issue. So there is communication, and there was communication sent out that students were going to be transferred out by the end of the month. But as you continue to hear from even just educators, there's mixed messages of, students are being moved out already, and they're going to be moved out before the end of the month. And so what we're trying to request is that there's additional communication and communication transparency, not just with the coalition and, let's say, myself, but also with the educators that are on the floor providing the day-to-day activities. What does that look like?
I think before we talk about what does it look like, what has happened already, right? We, end of July, walked into class and had a discussion around, oh, we're going to be moved. We knew starting the class the 1st of July that class would, we would more than likely be closing, the state bill would be closing at the end of September, and my class would end September 25th. That didn't happen. End of July, we heard something. 2 weeks ago, I went from 17 people in the class to six, and they were just literally ripped out of class, didn't know, didn't get to say goodbye or anything.
So you're seeing the classroom change right before your eyes, essentially.
Yes, people gone. I will never see them. We're trying to figure out how do we end the class. It was a restorative justice class, a circle-keeping class, which is essential to practice and facilitating. And they did facilitate a class on what does this closure mean.
Yeah. Yeah, because abrupt transfers, they can cause a lot of turbulence, right? But both for the people who are behind bars and for you, the educators. So I'm sure, Phyllis, you've developed some close relationships with your students on the inside, you know, through your teaching. So how does all of that make you feel?
I tell you, I've found out through an email that 30 people were removed, and of the 30, six of them were already gone from my class, and then another two were gone. I cried like a baby. It was unbelievable. Because of the, all what was in my head were the stories around the table, the table, the circle, the week before. The week before, these gentlemen said, well, I don't know what that means. Where am I going? All I know is this place. This is the only place I've known. People have died here. This feels like a big burial ground now. What do we do? And then others were like, well, I'm going to tell you, I'm scared. Because I don't know if I have to go into a fighting zone. Where are we going? What is our, what will our lives be about?
Alice, can you take the rest of us there who haven't been and describe for us what a classroom on the inside feels like and looks like, sounds like even?
Sure, absolutely. I've been teaching at Stateville for over 10 years now. And recently, in the last 2 years, I've started teaching a mixed enrollment class. This is a class that brings University of Chicago students into Stateville to have class with students who are earning their bachelor's degrees through the University Without Walls program. This class has been transformative for all of us. You know, we walk into the prison like everyone else who goes into a prison. We are all shaken down at the visitor center. We are only allowed to bring in certain materials. We ask that our students don't bring anything other than a notebook and a pen to write with.
And when you say shaken down, are you talking about a search?
Yes. Okay. We are searched. All the materials we bring in are subject to search. Then we walk, I think, maybe it's half a mile. I'm not sure. We walk a long ways to get to our classroom, which is inside an education building. And inside this education building, we have a small classroom with not tables. We wish we had a table. A conference room-like setting would be nice, but we sit in chairs that have individual desks on them. And usually we actually put ourselves into a circle. And one of the first things that students noticed when we walked in, that if you look up, there are nails on the ceiling that look like coffins. So they're all about, yes. And we also bring in one bottle of water each, right? And we're allowed that one bottle of water. And in spite of these stark conditions, I think we are able to transform that classroom into an environment where we all are learners and teachers together.
Flora, these abrupt transfers, they're impacting education opportunities, but can you just explain in broad strokes for us the different ways that the incarcerated men are being impacted here?
Of course. And even before that, right? So we're looking at the transfer issue, the abrupt issue, and we're looking at
dehumanizing education conditions. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons why the coalition was formed in 2016 was to be able to bring educators and institutions together as a group and be able to advocate against these challenges and issues. What does it look like? It looks like an instructor being able to bring in what they need to bring in to educate on the inside. There isn't a comprehensive policy right now, but that's our end goal, making sure that students are able to know where they're going to go because their family members need mm-hmm. to know. The challenge also is as Stateville is going to be closing, most of the prisons are at least, aside from Stateville, are 3 to 4 or 5 hours away.
Mm-hmm. Further away from Chicago.
Yes. When we do these drives, we really, you know, and this is where I commend all of us who provide education on the inside. You really have to, even at times, dehumanize yourself. You know, when you have your bottle of water, the amount of times perhaps that you may even just have to go to the bathroom, right, because of the restrictions that are set through. And so we're hoping that this challenge really brings in the group together. We're going to be meeting with IDOC at the end of this month mm-hmm. to be able to voice the feelings, the emotions. And again, IDOC is in the business for incarceration.
The Department of Corrections.
The Department of Corrections is in the business for incarceration. Our goal is to be able to educate, but to decarcerate. And so this is the first example of a prison closure, and it's impacting because it's impacting close to 1,400 students.
Yeah.
It's impacting because it's impacting most of the programs. Most of our programming is at Stateville, so now what's going to happen?
There's a lot of uncertainty. So Phyllis, I mean, education, it seems like here, it's not just about the degree, right? It's about the community and the sense of possibility that it can create.
It's literally their lives. It breathes life into them. Whether they're leaving, someone's leaving in 3 months, 6 months, or a life sentence, it gets them out of their cells. It creates a community, right? It creates civility, a sense of consciousness as in a reflection of not only I'm willing to serve my time, I deeply want to become a better human being. Mm. I am a better human being. I'm not the person who did this crime.
Tell us more about what you're hearing from them.
I'm hearing from them, especially in like a restorative justice class, right? How do we learn circle keeping, restorative justice to work and do this in prison with our peers? How do we make this place a more civilized place mm-hmm. where no one's harming each other? How do we also do that for our family members?
Yeah.
With our children who are angry that we're away, with our mother and father that we disappointed? How do we heal the repair? How do we say I'm sorry to the people we harmed, to the community we harmed? How do we say we're sorry to ourselves?
Alice, you also taught a mixed enrollment class at Stateville. This was with students from UChicago, right? So
that's right.
Was this any different?
I mean, it was transformative in the way that we were able to build community with one another. And I think that because the stakes are higher, right, when you're learning in a prison setting and when you know that people in the class are facing life sentences and are literally fighting for their freedom, mm-hmm. it meant that every single student, every single person who was in that classroom felt accountable to one another. And because of that, I think it elevated what it meant to learn together. And I think that it's that sense of community that has been lost and that we're losing in this moment is something that I think is overlooked. Mm. That over the last 10, 15 years when prison education programs came back in Illinois and were built back up in Illinois, that a community was created at Stateville. And right now, as people, you know, the class that I've been teaching over the summer, it's the think tank. We started with 19 students, the last class down to 7. And I believe we were scheduled to meet on the 19th, but I don't know if any students will be remaining.
Wow.
It's a real loss that people feel because they've developed chosen family with one another. Mm-hmm. They've developed community with one another. And now they are being scattered to prisons all over the
state.
Such
a rapid and a stark drop in numbers. You talked earlier, Flora, about location, right, which we know is so important as we talked about Stateville being so close to Chicago, and it's a city that's got a lot of well-resourced universities nearby. Now with these moves, we don't know where they're going to end up. Are there worries about the educational opportunities that are going to be offered at the new institutions?
Of course. When a student gets transferred, one, they're not aware of where they're going to be transferred until the day of, a day before, two. So that's a challenge. The second challenge is that there isn't enough programming inside of prisons. So there's 28 prisons. There's programming in 8 prisons. So we have pending 20 prisons.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, those 20 prisons are in Southern Illinois, most of them. It's education deserts. If you think about an instructor doing 10 times the amount of work to provide education on the inside, It will be inhumane to ask an instructor, travel 6 hours, build your curriculum plan, do what you have to do, but at the 10th potential. This is a huge step with Stateville. It's almost as if that accolade of university buildings is closing down, and now what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm. Anything to add, Phyllis, just as far as how it's possible to adapt your programming at a time like this?
We're in the middle of figuring that out, especially
at Governor State?
Or
at your Stateville class?
At the Stateville class. Mm-hmm. It is a community. It is. I know that people think about people being in prison, you're there to be punished. These men don't mind serving their time. They're doing their time. What they do care about is that someone sees their humanity.
So we're almost out of time, but I'd love to hear from all three of you briefly. I mean, you're all working together to build a more liberated and more connected world. What's guiding you? What's keeping you going right now? And it's a turbulent time. You first, Alice.
I mean, I think it's that our students actually keep us going. And I think that their humanity and the dignity that they've shown over these past years, but really also this past month when their lives have been so filled with the unknown, has been really remarkable and a testament to who they are. And so one thing I also like to bring into this conversation is that beyond thinking about how do we organize our classes at a prison that's further away, mm-hmm. which we will be doing and we absolutely are committed to doing, is so many of the students I know have, they've been in their 20, 30, 40 years already, right? They are transformed people. I believe without a doubt that they deserve to be home, and we need to be working towards more pathways for release so more people can come home. And I think that that's a critical part of what needs to be part of this conversation.
Yeah. What keeps you going, Phyllis?
Well, I'm just soaking in everything she's saying right about now. I'm like, yes, they have prepared to come home, right? Whenever that is. And they're not the same people. What keeps me going, I've been teaching since 2008, training social workers. I have never had this has been the most transformative experience of my life, teaching in prison. It grounds you, it lets you know, and it reminds us what really matters in this world. Mm. These men are serious. This has been by far the most outstanding class I've ever taught in.
It makes you emotional.
It beyond emotional. It grounds you into what really matters in this world and how we treat each other and also how we show up. Mm. And to see men who are hungry for education and wanting to test that education, not only on the outside, they want to test it on the inside too. They definitely want freedom, but they also realize the liberation of education and how that has freed and taken them to another level they could never imagine. And that creates a safer environment for everyone.
Give us a brief last word, Floor.
Of course. A second opportunity. I've been working with youth who are now unfortunately into the prison system, and I think of the 2,900 individuals inside. I think about that person who has been waiting 25 years for a program, I think about that person who's in a wheelchair that looks at education as a transformative method, but also as an opportunity for hope to be able to see their family members.
We'll leave it there. That's Flora Esquivel, who's Administrative Director for the Illinois Coalition for Higher Education in Prison. Alice Kim, who's Director of Practice for the Center for the Study of Race, Politics, and Culture at the University of Chicago. And Phyllis West, who's Director of the Social Justice Initiative at Governors State University. Thank you all so much.
Stay right here for more of Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Over the past few school years, the number of Illinois high schoolers graduating with college and career pathway endorsements has grown exponentially. Peter Medlin explains what it is and what it means for students.
How do we know a high school student is prepared for their career, whether they're going to college or straight into the workforce? Well, typically it's a high school diploma or a GED, but what about more specifically? How can we say this high school grad's well prepared to pursue a career in computer science or teaching? Well, in Illinois, students can now earn what's called a college and career pathway endorsement. It's a literal stamp on their high school diploma that says by completing a series of steps, they've demonstrated mastery in the area. But what exactly are those steps? Heather Penzak can explain. She's Director of Innovation and Implementations at the Ed Systems Center, housed at Northern Illinois University.
They've engaged in career-focused courses, they've participated in work-based learning, and they've also demonstrated readiness for college-level reading and math.
Students complete internships, team-based courses, and early college credit. And this pathway framework started back in 2016 with the Post-Secondary and Workforce Readiness Act. The State Board of Education developed the system, and school districts built each component part. And finally, in 2020, the first Illinois student earned the seal. And since then, it has been growing fast. In Illinois, 47 students across five districts were awarded in 2021. The class of 22 jumped to almost 600 students in 36 districts, and last year, over 1,000 students in 39 districts. And Penzak expects another leap this year, too. Bryce Shen is one of those students this year. He just graduated from Naperville North High School with an endorsement in business entrepreneurship and is headed to University of California, Berkeley to study business in the fall. With the pathway program, a few days a month, instead of going to school, Shen got to go into the city. And when he wasn't in class, his friends would naturally ask where he was.
I would tell them I was up in Chicago for my internship, and they'd be very shocked.
The internship was one step towards earning his endorsement, and every pathway student graduates with at least 60 internship hours. Jill Levacek is the district's director of innovation and learning.
We actually have six different pathway endorsements that students can earn.
They have two in agri-science, two information technology pathways, one in business and one in education, and they're planning to add even more next year. It's so ingrained that their course catalog maps out how each class connects to the pathways and even how extracurricular clubs and activities fit in. Levacek says their process starts pretty early.
So we start those conversations formally through curriculum in sixth grade.
By eighth grade, they want students to start understanding their options and what they're interested in. In eighth grade, that's when they hold what Levacek calls a career fair on steroids.
We have over 100 business partners attend. Students get to sample the different career cluster areas, and then they come back and talk about what they saw, what they learned, and how does that relate to my next step of high school.
And now you might be thinking, geez, eighth grade, isn't this all a bit too early to lock young students onto a path? What if they want to change their mind? Well, they do revisit the plans every year, and Helena Illich says having these work-based opportunities early actually allows for more flexibility and exploration instead of making you feel stuck in a box. She just wrapped up her first year at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and she was part of the first cohort of Naperville students earning their endorsements, hers, in computer science.
Solidify that I actually want to do this in a work environment, because I think there's a really big disconnect between like, oh, I like taking a course in this versus I actually like doing this for a job, because a lot of the work you're doing is different, even though the expertise might be the same.
She says there's an advantage to finding out early before you're in college and before you spend a lot of money pursuing something you might change your mind about. And Heather Penzak wants to clarify that not every school offers the same endorsements.
Depending what your employer partnerships look like, depending what your college partnerships look like, but also what is the local demand?
Legislation in 2022 expanded the pathway system. Unless they formally opt out, all Illinois high schools will be required to offer an endorsement starting with the class of 2027, who just finished their freshman year this spring. Lavacek says it's also been a great way for her district to strengthen bonds with local businesses, along with colleges and universities.
And it gave us ways to celebrate student success that wasn't just a test score or a grade.
Illick says her opportunities laid a strong foundation for her going into college.
I think a lot of the time college invites a lot of imposter syndrome or like insecurity because it's such a big change. But I kind of had this like solidified documented thing. I'm like, I can do this because I've done this internship in the past.
And as these programs grow, leaders like Lavacek hope the endorsement signals that this student is well prepared for the next stage of their life. I'm Peter Medlin.
A story of corporate greed, willful worker exploitation, and human tragedy in Bloomington Normal began nearly a century ago with the introduction of asbestos. And the investments in worker safety that the UNARCO company in Bloomington and others failed to make are paying dividends of a horrible sort, ones of blood and lost public treasure. Charlie Schlinker has more on a new exhibit at the McLean County Museum of History.
Sometimes dark stories, uncomfortable stories, tragic stories are important ones.
The anger that you have knowing that the company did this to your family, it eats on you daily.
Terry Redmond of Wapella lost his father, George Redmond, to intestinal cancer caused by asbestos exposure. The UNARCO plant on Bloomington's west side operated for nearly 20 years before it closed in 1970. George Redmond worked that entire time.
I watched him dwindle away at Carl Clinic in Champaign from a man that was about 175 to 80, 180 pounds down to just over 100 pounds. It was terrible. And all she wanted to do was go home and die.
Terry Redmond says when Dad was done with work each day, you would have thought he was a baker.
When he'd come home, those gray slacks were almost as white as his T-shirt. Us as little kids, my brother and I, we'd go up and slap his legs and watch the dust fly out. Well, it was asbestos.
Cheryl Wills lives near Colfax. She grew up near Aerosmith. Her dad, Willard Tipsword, worked at UNARCO, though only a few years in the 1950s. He then became a carpenter, and the exposure to the cancer-causing fibers continued in caulk, tiles, drywall, insulation, and a host of other products. Willard Tipsword died of mesothelioma, a particular kind of lung cancer strongly associated with asbestos exposure. He was a big guy, 6'2", who worked and worked. He never complained about anything, Wills says, until in his early 50s he started to get tired. He died at 57.
You just saw this very strong, hardworking man just withering away. You lost him day by day.
The deaths of more than 100 workers at the UNARCO plant have been documented as asbestos-related. That's a low number, because some death certificates say only cancer or respiratory disease, not a definitive link. Asbestos was mined before it was shaped into other products. The asbestos sent to the plant in Bloomington came from South Africa. Museum of History exhibit curator Susan Hartzold says there were also asbestos mines in the United States, Canada, India. It was internationally pervasive.
They crushed the rock, they crushed it again, and until it all broke down into soft, silky fibers. And then it would be like spinning yarn. And then it would be woven into fabric.
For many years, asbestos was considered a wonder product. Mike Matika helped put the exhibit together.
Anything from Christmas snow for under the tree to pipe insulation to firefighter clothing.
In the Bloomington plant, there wasn't a lot of attention to worker safety. Matika says many workers made the comment it was like snowing. When you look at photographs, it looks like a cotton mill.
You looked up through the skylights and it was just all these little twinkling fibers in the air that just coated everything.
In some years, the company provided little foam masks, but those were flimsy and quickly clogged. They weren't respirators. And Cheryl Wills says even the inadequate masks weren't always there. She recalls a story from her dad who said workers would tie men's handkerchiefs over their noses and mouths.
Management came out and made them take the hankies off of their faces. They would not let them wear hankies to protect themselves.
Wills is a nurse, and looking back on what her father said dismays her.
It was common sense that if you're breathing something in that is irritating your nose, your mouth, your throat, you can see it in the air, it can't be good for you. And so it makes me very, very angry that management would have stooped that low to knowingly make those people breathe that in.
The company did know. Retired attorney Jim Walker gave the Museum of History hundreds of case files of workers who ended up suing UNARCO and its successor company, Owens Corning, for their health problems. Again, here's Mike Matika.
The most shocking thing is already in the 30s, the industry is doing research because they know there's a hazard here. And they're paying for cancer research, but then they're declaring that research proprietary because they paid for it.
Company doctors may have made some warnings, but Mike Matika says they also played a part in the cover-up. It involved a twisted kind of worker health monitoring.
Workers were x-rayed on a regular basis, and once somebody showed signs of disease, the company would come and, boy, we're sorry, we think you're sick. We're going to have to let you go, but we'll give you a settlement if you'll sign this paper and agree not to sue.
UNARCO was in Cicero before it came to Bloomington. Terry Redmond says UNARCO moved to central Illinois when workers in Cicero started getting sick, and then when workers in Bloomington started to ail, he says they moved to Paris, Illinois.
So they were just outrunning their problem as people that worked there were getting sick.
Only in the late 60s and 70s do independent research and court cases begin to change the tide. Then came regulation, and the industry collapsed. Owens Corning bought the UNARCO plant in Bloomington. UNARCO went bankrupt in the 80s. Owens Corning lasted a couple decades longer before it, too, went under. But if you were an investor between the 1930s and 1960s, Mike Matika says you probably made a bunch of money with UNARCO.
They've made all this money on the suffering.
Terry Redmond says the death of his dad, George Redmond, was one of the lead cases in the many asbestos lawsuits filed.
We didn't know anything about going to court or what a class action lawsuit was, or people ended up with very little. And it's a crying shame.
He's still glad they participated in the suit because it exposed corporate America as bean counters.
If they know they're hurting an employee, they don't really care as long as they're making money. And if there's a settlement over what they did and they're still making money, they're going to go ahead and do what they need to do to make that profit.
Asbestos companies set up trust funds to pay for lawsuit settlements. Mike Matika says those were exhausted in 10 to 15 years, and the public is still paying the price.
Think about, since the 1980s, how many school buildings, how many corporate buildings, how much have local taxpayers spent on asbestos remediation, cleaning this up.
Terry Redmond says his father's death and the paltry help from the court case helped shape his politics from an early age, and it's still in his thoughts often.
Why, every day. Yeah. Every day. I think the government needs to do as much as they can to protect the workers because the companies, most of them, won't.
Certainly, asbestos is a story of consumer awareness. Matika says that's a story that never ends.
What about forever chemicals? You know, what are the things out there now that are being industrially used that consumers are buying that we may find out, our companies may already know, are hazardous?
Societal legacies can obscure what happens to individual people and families. The premature death of a loved one, Cheryl Wills says, can make one bitter.
The fact that it was preventable, that there were bad people making decisions to endanger these people's lives. And even now, that makes me angry.
Will says she's tried to channel her anger into focusing on the future and preventing such things. She says her daughter watched her grandfather die slowly and painfully as a child and was aware of the cause.
That daughter has grown up to be a labor educator now. She is nationally and cross-border training people on workers' rights.
which is basically human rights.
The asbestos deaths affect descendants of those who died in many ways. Terry Redman says it hurts family sustainability, for one.
You don't think about this, but it's the generational wealth that you lose, too. My father dying at 43, making a darn good living as a laborer right here in McLean County. You know, there's 25 years that he could have worked and built up an estate, but that was all taken away. And that affects every generation thereafter.
And the most telling loss is one that may never be apparent. How can children mourn what they never knew?
I have three children, and I tell them frequently that, oh, if your grandpa could only have seen you. And it's painful every day.
Charlie Schlinker with that report. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us again next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at this station's website. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.